here in Youngstown.
Here in Youngstown. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. Sad. Real quick, to all of my union member friends who voted for Donald Trump, I hope what happened today is going to be a stinging wake-up call to what to expect from the rest of this administration. Hopefully only a couple of more months. But still, today, the Trump administration and ultimately the federal government did it in about-face. Just turning their back on public sector workers and the long-standing Supreme Court decision known as Abood. And what we're seeing is a massive swing in policy, and it's not only disruptive, I would argue it is incredibly dangerous. And that's why I've asked Eric Loomis to come talk with us, assistant professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, also fantastic blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
So today, like I said, the amicus brief by the Trump administration, Department of Justice, came, hit the front pages, about face, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, it's an about face in two administrations. I mean, you had one administration, the Obama administration, that maybe wasn't everything labor wanted it to be, but it fundamentally supported unions. And you have a Trump administration that wants to destroy the union.
And look, this isn't even something that George W. Bush went after.
Right. I mean, you know, this is an extremist moment in American history. And it is the intention of the Trump administration and conservatives generally, certainly those on the Supreme Court, to literally destroy the labor movement. And this will, you know, have an enormous impact on public sector unions and will significantly hurt working people's voices in the American political system.
You know, I go back to John Roberts' confirmation hearing, and maybe you remember this moment where he was asked about decided law, and he gave the whole balls and strikes talk, the whole stare decisis, decided law, you know, we're not going to be judicial activists, all of this stuff. And I fast forward to today, I look at all of this as a construct from the Supreme Court, because Alito basically called for this back in the Knox case several years back.
Yes. And you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, conservatives used to talk about liberals and their, quote, judicial activism, that they were creating law. Well, what that really was projection, because that's what they wanted to do. And that's what they're doing. They are creating law, destroying decades and decades of labor law, as well as other, you know, environmental law and all sorts of regulations that this nation created to make it a more even and equal society. And John Roberts and Sam Alito and now Neil Gorsuch, they are absolutely determined to overturn any power unions have. And this is the consequence of electing Donald Trump.
Let me ask you this. Because I know a lot of people are, you know, heads down because the Friedrichs case ended up in a deadlock 4-4 because of Scalia's passing. And now, obviously, Trump has replaced Scalia in the stolen seat with someone much worse than Scalia. Is there any hope, any chance that Kennedy changes his mind from the 4-4 vote and becomes the swing vote to say, hey, look, this was decided law. This was the law of the land for years. We can't have this insane swinging of the pendulum.
Well, you never really know quite what Anthony Kennedy is going to do. So it's always theoretically possible that especially if the decision they want to make it too extreme, but there's not much in Kennedy's history that makes him somebody sympathetic to unions. And the fact that he cast this vote on what is basically the same case in the Friedrichs case makes that very unlikely. This is not a hope. If it's my union, and it is my union, I'm not hoping that maybe Anthony Kennedy changed his mind. What I'm doing is advocating that we make sure that we have as many of our members signed up and active as possible, because that's really the only solution here, because it's a well over 90% chance that the Abood case, which is the predecessor to this, that allowed for you know, basically public sector unions to operate as they do, there's a 90% chance that's going to be overturned.
Right. And what this would ultimately do is starve those public sector unions of resources to negotiate those contracts, because it would basically be the right to freeload.
Yes, and not only and yes to negotiate those contracts, but also, and this is critical in understanding why conservatives are declaring war on unions, it also starves them of resources to give money to Democrats.
Yep.
It starves them of resources to lobby in Washington on behalf of working people. And this is, they know this. This is why they're targeting them. Right? And so some of it's about contracts and about worker power at the workplace, but it's also very much an attack on any institution that has any ability to influence the nation to the left. And that's the same reason why this tax plan that they're pushing attacks universities, because they see universities as a bastion of the left, and they are going after every institution that is not dominated by the right wing. And so this is part of a larger constellation of right-wing goals by extremists that control our country.
Yeah, and you see that all the time. I get emails all the time from, you know, Students for Choice, and you throw out all these euphemistically named groups, and it's really all about targeting professors who have an opinion and share that. I mean, it's just crazy. So let me ask you the other side of this, because, you know, I have some very optimistic union friends who go, okay, so we know where this is going. Is this the moment in time where we declare the end, the death of the New Deal era labor peace, and end up becoming a much more militant labor union? I'm curious where you see things going in the aftermath of this.
Well, it's always possible, but I don't think that the rank and file of most unions, and certainly not public sector unions, for the most part, are in that place. I think there's a group of leaders and a group of organizers within many unions, and especially at the local level, who might like to see that as a militant, and might like to see this as a moment where a new militant unionism rises up. But I think they need to. But I think that we need to go into our workplaces and ask ourselves, where do our coworkers stand on this? Because I know that mine. I mean, you know, we're a union campus, you know, at the University of Rhode Island. And I don't really see my coworkers ready to, you know, march to the barricade. And I worry that, you know, maybe that happens, but it's a multi-decade process of losing people, becoming more radical and realizing we need a more radical movement. But I don't want to have 30 or 40 years of terrible things happening to us to get to that point. I mean, that's not an ideal goal. So I'm skeptical that in the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see this, you know, militant labor movement come out of the ashes of this. I don't really know what the evidence is that that's going to happen.
No, I'm with you. And you look at what the rise of the New Deal era labor movement and you know, obviously the birth of the most prosperous working class in history. And it came after, you know, decades of you know, depression and starvation and desperation and exploitation and poverty wages and all of that stuff. And I don't want my kids to have to relive that.
Right. Suffering is not a good thing. And I think that it's easy to look back at the past and say, oh, look how militant they were. But that militancy came out of tremendous personal suffering that most of us don't really understand. And I don't think that's something that we want to replicate when you start understanding the details of how terrible the lives of the working class were in 1929.
Now, on the political side, because there are some friends of mine who are saying, well, what will happen is, you know, finally Democrat will pull Democrats back into being pro-labor. Is the Democratic Party the savior in all this, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't call it the savior. I would call it a necessary tool. I mean, I think that the labor movement traditionally, the reason that it has to have close ties to one political party anyway, is that it really can't succeed and never has succeeded when the government has declared war on it. And this is, I think, is the most critical point about American labor history that a lot of people, including radicals, don't really understand. More important than militancy has been the role of the federal government. And if the federal government is willing to tolerate unions' existence, then they can succeed and do quite well. And if they're not, then they do poorly. And so they really have to have a Democratic Party be actively pro-union, or at least a mediating force that's balanced in order for labor to succeed. I do think the Democratic Party is significantly to the left of where it was 15 years ago on a lot of these issues. A lot of the anti-labor Democrats are gone. But part of the problem here is that what politicians respond to is power and in the modern era, money. And if you take union money out of politics, which is exactly what this case does by undermining the ability of SEIU and AFSCME and other public sector unions to donate and to have the resources to do so, you're taking even less union influence, or you're taking even more, more union influence out of the political system, making politicians less beholden to labor unions. So, you know, the Democratic Party is necessary, absolutely, but it every day makes this a harder path to get back to where we were, which is, again, the goal of the right-wingers involved in it.
Yeah, and I have friends who say, well, they're just going to do away with unions. I go, no, they'll never do away with unions. You always need someone to kick.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it's much easier to just make, you know, to make labor unions irrelevant than to go to the trouble of destroying them entirely or making them illegal. Because that, you know, to destroy the whole system, and that's why I don't think they'll ever say repeal the National Labor Relations Act. They'll just control all the mechanisms of it to make it impossible to actually organize and sign a contract. That's easier for them than to actually declare the union movement illegal. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think they're going to get rid of it. They're just going to make it as difficult as possible to organize or for unions to do anything effectively, which, if it's like it was the last time it was like this, when union, you know, 100 years ago when unions didn't really have any power but certainly existed, you know, it means using the courts against them at every term. And you're seeing this already, right? I mean, yep. Unions have restrictions on speech that no other institution in the country has. And that is because right-wingers are trying to limit their power and to limit the power of workers.
Explain that. Tell people how you see their limits on speech.
Well, for instance, something like this Janus case, right? That they're calling this a speech issue, that unions are, you know, suppressing the speech of others by forcing people to pay union dues that then they give to Democrats and this sort of thing. Whereas, you know, there are many, for instance, say the AARP, right? Many, many millions of people are members of the AARP, right? But, you know, they don't have to go through this whole rigmarole on how to use their lobbying money. There are institutions that are developed around political activity that only apply to unions. Certainly don't apply to corporations or corporate lobbies. Certainly don't apply to other sorts of lobbies.
Well, wouldn't the argument on the other side of that, Eric, be that those are voluntary organizations and that, you know, that you're being forced to join a union and pay dues or at least pay fair share dues? Isn't that their argument?
Well, I mean, that is their argument. I think the question around that argument is whether or not a institution has the right to, you know, or has the obligation really to negotiate around a broad series of issues that organization sees as within, you know, is crucial for the future and for the lives of those people. And so, you know, it's an argument that, you know, you can make, and it's not entirely illegitimate in a sense, except that really, as the courts apply these laws, only applies to unions, and they don't apply it to other sorts of organizations, even if that money is not necessarily voluntary.
Now, here's the other part of this. Now, if this case goes the way I think we all agree it's going to go, isn't that a place for labor to go and say, look, now we should have no restrictions on our ability to use our dues dollars that we see fit?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. And I do think, though, that the courts will simply, as you talked about earlier with the way that John Roberts is making up law, I mean, I think that this is very likely that they will simply create new restrictions. You know, that's the way this is going because, you know, you can't, it's a mistake, I think, for unions to believe that they're entering into a world where these people are principled. I think that they are determined to create law wherever they can, and they will apply it differently to labor unions, right? That they are making law based around the political positions. And so, you know, somebody like Sam Alito, or Scalia was the worst about this, who would make this big deal about originalism and about his principles, but then routinely violate them any time it fit his own personal political agenda. And that's how these people are, and that's how these people are acting toward the labor movement. And so, yes, that is absolutely the argument that we should make. We should make arguments that, you know, that if we're going to negotiate a contract, it should only apply to those who are union members, for instance. There's a lot of arguments that can be made out of this.
Do you advocate for that? I mean, Eric, do you advocate for the contract should only apply to union members? Because, you know, I see that as a slippery slope to where the employer goes, fine, you'll get this, but we're going to give the people who don't join, you know, bonuses or whatever. I see that as a divide and conquer thing, whereas, you know, maybe I'm just a kind of a purist and think that you have to have everybody in to have the kind of bargaining power that you need.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily advocating for it. I guess what I'm saying is that this should be part of a conversation. That right now, after this, really all the old rules really don't apply anymore.
Yeah.
And so if this is going to be a leaner and perhaps meaner labor movement, then I think that a lot of questions that have been off the table ever since labor law was really created in the 1930s become back on the table again. So who does a union represent could be part of that. I'm not advocating for any particular position because I think these are very complex questions. And while I am a labor historian and labor activist, nobody has all the answers here at all.
No, I agree.
I think that there's a series of conversations that need to happen. People need to try different things, see what works, and move from there because we're kind of starting over.
Yeah, I was at the AFL's convention recently in St. Louis, and I asked the question, you know, are we at that moment, you know, like when the IWW went down or the Knights of Labor went down, to where we figure out what's next and what institutions pop up in that place. And that question didn't go over really well.
Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising because I think that, you know, so long as there are people who are representing anybody, they're not going to really want to go there.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to have to come from activists outside the labor movement or, people in new industries trying to organize and these sorts of things. Because I think that, you know, if you're an established union, even if you're declining, you're probably still going to be fundamentally your primary interest is going to be representing those people that you have left. And it's hard to move from that point to, okay, you know, we really need to start something entirely new and spend a lot of resources on that. And I think that you're already sort of seeing that, right? I mean, so SEIU, you know, who's spent a tremendous amount of money funding different kinds of projects, such as the Fight for 15, pulling back a lot of those resources and knowing that Janus is about to hit and needing to, or deciding that they need to spend more resources defending what they have.
So yep.
I don't blame them, but I think that your question is right on. And I think that your question is a very important one that we all have to come together to figure out because the old way simply is not going to work anymore. Even if you know, eventually Trump goes away, Democrats take back over, it's a long haul back.
Yeah, it is. Eric, I appreciate the thoughts. I appreciate the time. Love to have you come back on again and share some more thoughts with us.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Always good talking to our good friend Eric Loomis, professor there at University of Rhode Island, historian, great blogger, Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog. Check that out. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. Measures we explore, marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out, where's our government? Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account that we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
Class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.